Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in over 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. The Hinckley is pleased to announce that on November 5th, we will be hosting international bestseller Malcolm Gladwell, and we invite you to go next door for tickets. Please visit our website for additional information as well at www.hinckley.utah.edu, or like I said, you can go next door. The title of today's forum is A Line in the Sand, Syria and U.S. Policy, and I will be introducing today's moderator, John Davidson, who is a political science student and also a member of the Student Advisory Committee for Poli-Sci.
I don't know. I like to stay here. It feels weird, though, doesn't it? Is it like...
Thank you, Kendall. I'm excited to see so many people here and that the house is full, and again, thank you to our three panelists for taking time out of your day to be here. So we'll go down the line and we'll introduce our panelists so that you can get to know a little bit more about them. And then as soon as I've finished introducing them, we can applaud for all three of them for taking time out to be here. Our first panelist is Professor Benny, who has recently joined the Political Science Department here at the University of Utah. Prior to arriving this fall, she was a researcher at the Earth Research Institute and a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the University of California, Santa Barbara. In addition, from 2002 to 2007, she worked in the Policy and Global Affairs Division of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. Dr. Benny teaches in the field of international relations, international and comparative political economy, and environmental politics. Our second panelist is Professor Steele. Professor Steele is the Francis D. Wormuth Presidential Chair and Professor of Political Science at the University of Utah. He has also taught at the University of Kansas. He is the author of three books, most recently, Alternative Accountabilities in the Global Politics, The Scars of Violence. And our third panelist is Professor Chatterjee. Professor Chatterjee is a senior advisor and professorial fellow in the J.S.J. Quincy College of Law and a global ethics fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs in New York City. Prior to holding his current position, he was a member of the philosophy faculty at the University of Utah. His areas of specialization are justice and global initiative, ethics of war and peace, and philosophy of religion and culture. Each panelist will have 10 minutes to go over the materials that they have brought with us to share. And then after these three 10-minute sessions, we'll go to a question and answer period where we'll have a couple traveling mics and we can take a few questions from those that are here attending. Go ahead, Professor Benny.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming and joining us today. So I prepared a short statement, so you'll bear with me, because some of it I will actually be reading. There's a bit of detail, and I wanted to make sure I had all the detail down. So the Obama administration's call for punitive strikes in Syria following reports of the chemical weapons attack has prompted the most serious debate yet in U.S. policy circles following or in accordance to intervention. Interpreting these events over the past few months has been difficult and sometimes confusing. To provide some guidance, the tradition of international relations has often relied on historical and philosophical reasoning along with international law to interpret these events. In this case, it's important to remind ourselves why international law is so important. In a nutshell, states benefit from conforming to international law because norms that states follow, including the U.S., provide an ordered system and general expectations about behavior. So just like we all like to know how much our paycheck will be at the end of the week so we can live by a budget and adjust our lives accordingly, states too benefit from living in an ordered international society. What makes the case in Syria so complex is that there are three competing norms that I'd like to address today. The first is the right to intervention, the second being norms against the use of chemical weapons, and the third being the norm of civilian protection. Let me begin by addressing the norm of intervention. So the prospect of intervention is perhaps the most relevant from the U.S. perspective. Not only did the precedence of preemption under George W. Bush cause more harm than good, But the strike in Syria would likely raise considerable questions of legality that would probably be detrimental to the U.S. policy in the long term. So the first concern that I have as far as the aspects of intervention is on legal grounds. So without a UN Security Council resolution authorizing universally agreed upon force, a claim of self-defense, or something on those legal grounds, it would be difficult for a country to legally intervene in Syria. The United States and its partners do not have a resolution, nor do they have a strong legal defense for self-defense, making this action weak on legal grounds. And although the United States could make an argument that chemical weapons pose a serious threat to the region, it's well understood that innocent civilians in Syria are the target of such weapons. As such, an attack would be seen as an attack on sovereign rights of the Syrian state. A second area of concern from the international law perspective is the idea of precedence. So despite treaties outlawing chemical weapons, there's no precedence for using military intervention in the case of intervening or responding to these violations. Although the United States and its allies have a strong interest in deterring the use of chemical weapons and ethically and have a moral right to do so, any intervention on these grounds would not be based on a legal precedence. The final perspective is the idea of extraordinary circumstances. So if there is no legal basis for military intervention in Syria, any use of external force against the Syrian government could not be justified unless it was for humanitarian purposes. So states are more accepting of intervention in extreme cases when all the diplomatic options have already been used up. And with the recent Russian-led plan to disarm Assad's regime, the chemical weapons problem in Syria needs to be addressed from these earlier stages of diplomatic approach. In fact, efforts to rapidly disarm and dismantle Syria's regime using a chemical weapons program could help to strengthen the U.S.'s position in a worst-case scenario if Assad were to backslide or were to actually be uncooperative in the long run. So this brings me to the second concept I want to talk about today, and that's this idea of the use of chemical weapons or the norms against the use of chemical weapons. Like many of the norms surrounding war, the starting point for this problem goes way back. There's a long-standing tradition. For our purposes, I'm going to begin with the Geneva Protocol, which is a treaty prohibiting the first use of chemical weapons in international armed conflicts. It was signed all the way back in 1925 and put into force in 1928. The Geneva Protocol prohibits the use of asphyxiating, poisonous, or other gases, and all liquids, materials, or devices, and bacteriological methods of warfare. Today, this protocol is understood to be a general prohibition on chemical and biological weapons, but since the treaty didn't cover the use of production, storage, or transfer of such weapons, additional treaties were later put into place to cover these aspects. So in 1972, the Biological Weapons Convention was created, and then in 1993, the Chemical Weapons Convention. The Chemical Weapons Convention is an armed control treaty that outlaws the production, stockpiling, and use of chemical weapons and their precursors. And this has been brought up most recently in many of the news outlets that you hear about. So as of September 2013, 190 countries have signed on to this treaty. The parties' main obligation being that under this convention, they're prohibited from the use and production of chemical weapons, and as well as destruction of all chemical stockpiles worldwide. So as of January of this year, 78% of global known stockpiles of chemical weapons have been destroyed based on this treaty. As of last month, Syria signed on to the treaty itself and has agreed to the provision and pending its entry into force on October 14th. According to recent reports, they've already begun, as of October 6th, the destruction of the Syrian chemical weapons production facilities. And international inspectors claim the Syrian government has been cooperative. However, American officials say that while the Syrian government's preliminary inventory and chemical weapons presented last month was extensive, some experts say it was not complete. Subsequently, the disarmament effort will depend heavily on the cooperation going forward of the Syrian military, as well as Russia's willingness to use its leverage with the Syrian authorities. So why, if Assad's forces have been killing tens and thousands of civilians with conventional weapons, why has the use of chemical weapons been such an important force in this debate? From an international law perspective, the use of chemical weapons is a step beyond. Since World War II, governments and armies have gradually forsworn weapons that do not distinguish between soldiers and civilians. These include nuclear weapons, biological and chemical arms, and also landmines and cluster munitions. The treaties that ban such arms are building blocks in a decade-long campaign by human rights activists to insist that warfare be constrained by international law. As such, soldiers should be killing soldiers, and generals should be aiming their weapons away from civilians. International laws and informal warnings of retaliation are designed to dissuade dictators and terrorists from using weapons of mass destruction under any circumstances. A failure to enforce such norms in Syria, according to many, would likely lower the threshold for chemical weapons. Despite the ethical and legal norms, chemical weapons and the conventions that cover them are sadly only meant for international combatants. In the case of Syria, some argue, chemical weapons were not used on international combatants. Instead, they were used on citizens of the same state, this being only the second occurrence of this in modern history. So this brings me to my final norm that I want to address today, and that's the responsibility to protect innocent civilians. The recent U.S.-Russian deal to bring Syrian chemical weapons under international scrutiny has been hailed as a victory of sorts for the norm against chemical weapons. However, the chemical weapons bans are only part of the international system of rules that strives to reduce the impacts of war. Even predating the treaties used for chemical weapons was the basic requirement that civilians be protected from attacks. The notion that civilians should not be intentionally targeted during war is a long-standing and widespread tradition, and it's an important element of just war theory and Islamic law. As such, it's a keystone of modern international humanitarian law. Today, civilian immunity arguably ranks among the world's most important norms to protect. And that is what makes the discussion about Syria's alleged use of chemical weapons so confusing. Much of the debate about U.S. military strikes stressed the importance of preserving the taboo about chemical weapons, which were banned in part because of their indiscriminate nature against civilians. But in Syria's case, it appears that the Syrian regime aimed to kill civilians with the alleged chemical attacks on the suburbs of Damascus last month. Hardly anyone concludes that the civilian deaths were simply collateral damage in a war against the rebels. International humanitarian law emerged to mitigate the miseries of war, particularly those involving and waging against civilians. So although the world has moved to address the issue of chemical weapons, the norms to protect innocent civilians may be overlooked in the long run. That the security forces under Assad's authority have perpetuated war crimes against humanity, including the use of chemical weapons, is unfortunately beyond a doubt. And as the head of the state, he has the effective control over his subordinates and must be held accountable before the International Criminal Court or a post-conflict tribunal in Syria. However, Assad's forces were not the only ones responsible for the 100,000 reported deaths in the civil war so far. If international law is to prevail, all those accountable for the deaths of innocent civilians need to be brought to justice through an ordered and systematic process. Only then will the responsibility to protect be fully borne out. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Steele?
Thank you. Thank you all for being here, and thanks to Jonathan and Zach for getting this together, and thanks to my fellow panelists. I enjoy hearing what you had to say. So I approach this issue and the issue of Syria from a couple of different angles. One of my research areas and teaching areas is international ethics. I'm teaching a class next spring on international ethics, and when you say international ethics, you might think that those that do research in international ethics are approaching it from a standpoint of trying to tell everyone the way the world should be. And that might be a secondary purpose for folks like me that are interested in international ethics, but I approach it a little bit from a social scientific angle, even though I don't think anybody would really call me much of a social scientist. And that is that I'm interested in the way that ethics out there, ethical considerations out there, ethical achievements or conventions that we have out there, shape or stimulate or prohibit certain behaviors of international actors, whether they're states, non-state actors, groups, individuals, and so on. So I'm interested in ethics from the standpoint of how ethics out there impact the behaviors of international actors. And so the Syrian case and what's been happening over the last few months and even the last couple of years is very interesting to me on that in that respect. But then that also allows me, if I engage sort of the way that ethics and the content of ethics out there, the way that impacts the behaviors of actors out there, that also allows me in sort of a secondary role to engage that critically. And so I do have a sort of normative take on what's been happening in Syria and what's been happening in the broader Middle East and what's been happening in U.S. foreign policy for a long time now. That comes from that primary purpose of looking at the way that ethics is involved in the behaviors of international actors. So if the international ethics side of me finds the Syrian case important, especially in terms of the content of the norm against chemical weapons use, and why the norm of chemical weapons use seems to be such a taboo or a red line, and some of the other considerations that Professor Benny was just talking about in terms of civilians being vulnerable, don't seem to be a red line. And so I want to engage that in my talk. But there's also a couple of other angles in terms of my interest in U.S. foreign policy that I find interesting about this case. One is that, and I won't have time to be able to talk about this, so I'll just throw these out here, how a mistake, a gaffe by John Kerry, and that's a redundant phrase sometimes, John Kerry and a gaffe, how that is somewhat responsible, right? I mean, we could do a counterfactual and ask, if John Kerry hadn't said what he said at that press conference in London that one morning in that fateful week about Syria getting rid of all of its chemical weapons, if the United States would have followed through and had strikes. That's interesting. That's interesting from a whole bunch of different standpoints in terms of causality and being social science and the development of international politics and major events. So the role of chance or fortune or luck, I think, is important. And then also a sort of interest in the domestic influences on U.S. foreign policy and whether the opposition to strikes that we saw within the Republican Party represents a new renaissance or restraint in the Republican Party, or whether it's just a really idiosyncratic, unique circumstance. So I can talk about those in the Q&A if you'd like. But getting back to the issue of the chemical weapons ban or the norm against chemical weapons use, we heard a lot of folks, I think, at least colloquially, ask why the use of chemical weapons in Syria represented a red line, while the roughly, we were told, 100,000 civilians, or at least individuals, who had been killed in the civil war through conventional means did not also represent a red line. Why was it all of a sudden the use of chemical weapons that was special here, that required a response? Well, a lot of people have done work on this in international relations. Professor Richard Price, for instance, from the University of British Columbia, has for the last 20 to 25 years done a lot of work on different taboos in international politics, including the chemical weapons ban. And I think he's done a lot of the best work investigating just how this norm against chemical weapons use developed into the robust prohibitive norm it is today. So Price first engages these other arguments for why there would be this norm against chemical weapons use. One of the most common ones you hear, and I even heard it again sort of resurrected in the debates around Syria, is, well, the reason why we even have this norm is simply because chemical weapons are just not militarily useful. Mm-hmm. So because they're not militarily useful, it's easier to get states to sign on to this possibility of banning their use. And states don't want it reciprocally used against them, right? So they don't use it because they don't want another state to use it against them, so they agree to this. I think that's true in general, but Price has shown in his work, and we know through historical works, that while in general chemical weapons are not a useful weapon of war, usually, depending on the circumstance, there are certain instances we've found, especially in World War II, the Germans facing the Normandy invasion, the United States in its island hopping campaign throughout the Pacific theater, that they would have been useful. And yet, even though they would have been useful, there was little consideration on behalf of those powers to use them. So Price at least dismisses that in terms of the military effectiveness or not argument as the reason, as not being the reason for why we have a chemical weapons ban. Instead, he suggests a more historical approach to understanding the norm against chemical weapons use. And so he looks at the sort of history and the development of this norm, beginning in the late 19th century, early 20th century through today. And his argument is that there were some background conditions that kind of set aside chemical weapons as something that at least elites in the early part of the 19th century at the Hague conferences in 1899 and 1907 noticed. One was, of course, the impact upon noncombatants. And what's interesting, in the Hague conferences, these elites are discussing this even before chemical weapons are being developed or used. So they at least can envision what chemical weapons or a form of poison gas or chemical weapons would do to noncombatants. And also there's this connection to poison, which it sort of had a stigma. Poison always has a stigma, but it had a stigma going back centuries in global politics to being an illegitimate way to wage violence or war. But what Price also shows is that there's a sort of snowball effect to where this gets brought up in the Hague conferences, chemical weapons are used in World War I. There's a reference to the illegality of chemical weapons, and so the Geneva Protocols provide a little bit more momentum in terms of banning their use. And that norm gets developed throughout the 20th century, but one of the key aspects of a chemical weapons ban that the developed or major powers find in their interest, or at least that it makes possible, is that it was reinforced because, according to Price, it provided the developed countries one way to distinguish themselves as civilized versus these uncivilized actors or countries or groups who use it. And so you see this in the discourses throughout the 20th century in the rare instances when chemical weapons are used, including in the 1980s when Iraq uses them against Iran and then also against the Kurdish population shortly thereafter, that we civilized nations don't use chemical weapons, and it's the uncivilized nations that do. So that's a little bit less of a linear reason for why the chemical weapons taboo or whatever was developed, obviously in conjunction with some of these other linear developments in international law that Professor Benny mentioned. So the development of this norm is a little bit more contingent or haphazard or unique. So it is interesting when people ask that question. Sometimes they probably mean it rhetorically, about what makes chemical weapons so abhorrent compared to, say, mowing down civilians with machine guns or bombing them with conventional artillery. So those of you that maybe ask that question, say, why does that represent a red line? I get it. But I guess my response question is, why is that made? Why are we making that distinction? Why are we asking that? Is it for rhetorical points? Is it to say we can't enforce all norms against deadly or cruel force against civilians, so let's not enforce any? Or is it, in this case, a reason to prevent U.S. strikes against Syria? So one aspect about the norm against conventional weapons is that it is at least restrictive, in my view, and we need, in my view, more norms against the use of force rather than less. So if the point in bringing up what makes this norm different from others is to investigate ways to expand our understanding of what should not be allowed in war or global violence, then I'm all for it. Or if it's to bring up the folly of U.S. strikes, I'll entertain that as well. But sort of in conclusion, one thing that I think seems to be lost in this discussion around the norms against chemical weapons use has been that norm has been strengthened, not weakened, since the sort of at least international community tried to resolve this in the last few weeks. One thing that all of the actors agreed upon, whether it was the United States, the UK, the Security Council, or the Syrian regime, or the Russians, right, the heroic Russians that came in and resolved all this, is that nobody endorsed the use of chemical weapons. The Syrian regime said, well, it wasn't us that did it, right? It happened, but we didn't do it. The rebels did it. The Russians say, well, we're not exactly quite sure who did it, but let's just agree that we need to get rid of them, right? That's what's interesting about this norm is that this and the ultimate resolution and process going forward, and the original video of the horrible scenes that we saw, right, that you could see on the internet, of the actual attack itself and the effects on non-combatants, all of that has reinforced this notion that chemical weapons should be banned. Now, I would say that in that case, even though the norm against chemical weapons use has been compromised in this one case, that the norm itself has been strengthened. That stands in stark contrast, in my view, to another norm that took a beating in the 2000s, and that was the norm against torture. Mm-hmm. I think that norm, especially because of not just the United States practicing it and other regimes practicing it somewhat on a widespread basis in the 2000s, but also the justifications we still hear in the United States today and the popularity of the norm, the popularity of torture itself in the United States amongst the public, it's increasing, not decreasing, the further we get from the war on terror, that norm is on shakier ground than the norm against chemical weapons use. And so it's to the extent that we should support norms being strengthened, that's one of the only silver linings I see coming out of Syria. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. And then we'll continue with our final panelist, Professor Chatterjee.
Thanks. Thanks for having me here. I did not bring anything with me. I, in fact, have a few ideas, mostly based on what I heard, and then let me comment on them. The basic nitty-gritty of the issues are really well covered in these two talks, so I would not get into them, but I would like to get into a few foundational, broader issues to give you a certain background of where we are and where we are going, and hopefully that would help. By the way, you might notice perhaps I have a strange accent, a strange Utah accent, you know. I've been living in Utah for quite a long time, so please forgive me, pardon me for that. So, firstly, we find three distinct trends in our culture in the United States today, and let's see what we see what might happen or what may come out of those three. One is that when it comes to American governance, we are running our government through perpetual crisis. We are always in a crisis mode, and most, if not all of them, are spurious. They're just made up. They don't need to be there. That's truly unfortunate. On the international scene, our foreign policy is guided by perpetual war for perpetual peace. So perpetual crisis in governance at home and perpetual war for the quest for perpetual peace abroad, that perhaps doesn't take us anywhere, or is it going to take us someplace? Let's find out. And then the third trend we find, again, to get back to the domestic scene, this, what we call, the slow but steady Talibanization of the American culture over the years. Slow but steady Talibanization of the American culture. What do I mean by that? Are we turning into Talibans, into the Talibans? No. But the idea of this God, gun, and country, and the congruence of these three, and more that we harp on that, that is the Taliban mindset. That is what you call the tribal mindset. Mm. And tribal mindset in a globalized world, in a global world, is quite dangerous. That's the recipe for terrorism, you know? And so we have to be careful about that extremely. And we're not doing too much. In fact, it's getting even perhaps worse. That brings me to this idea of the so-called American exceptionalism, you know? That's connected directly to this tribal mindset, you know? Because every country believes that they're exceptional. They have something to offer, something unique that other countries don't. So what is so special about American exceptionalism? Whatever that is, we all know the pros and cons, but the one thing when it comes to international relations and fighting war abroad and all that is that we tend to believe that because we are exceptional, we don't need to look out in the global world and learn from other countries or join hands with them and be like them, you know, on an equal footing and all that. We can have our ways imposed on the outside world. And that has not served us very well. In fact, we know that. So given that, then the question that I would like to get into is what Tabitha started with at the very beginning of her talk, which is why international law matters. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of American exceptionalism and the idea of international law, they don't go together. One cancels the other. The whole basis, normative basis of international law is that all countries are equal and they have their sovereignty and we cannot take them for granted or we cannot violate them. That's the whole basis of international law, both normative and also practical. Now, but this whole idea that because we are exceptional, we have some right. Some people even call perhaps this God-given right to do things because we're on the right side of the issues that violates the basic norm of international law. So why is it that international law matters? It matters because we have to live together in this world. And the world is getting smaller and smaller every day. Given that, if we don't show regard and respect for international law in the name of upholding international law because others violate it, then we get into this perpetual paradox that may not be that obvious to us, we're insiders, but the moment you go abroad and travel around, which I do all the time, that last 1 year I have not been teaching and I have been just traveling around giving talks, I realize, wow, how transparent it is to the outside world, this big gap between our rhetoric and our practice, you know, and that does not make us look good to the outside world. That in fact makes us less effective. So, this militarization of American foreign policy, why is it that we find that trend of what I call this perpetual war for perpetual peace? Let's take a look at one. Because of lack of time, I cannot get into the details. Of course, these are extremely complicated matters. I wish I had all the time. I'm sure you do too. But let's take a look at the idea of warfare, okay? Because that's so much on the scene these days and part of our foreign policy, our psyche and all that. There is this notion, what we call preemptive war, mm-hmm. preemptive war, to preempt an imminent threat, a threat that's in the making or that has already taken place. We have to defend ourselves. When we have to defend ourselves because of some imminence, something about to happen or did happen, then we engage, and if we then engage in arms warfare, that is called preemptive war. That is sanctioned by international law. That is also sanctioned by the traditional just war theory. That is done in the name of defending ourselves. And we have a right, of course, just like anybody else, to defend ourselves. Okay, that's also true in domestic law as well. Now, when it comes to preventive war, that's an entirely different issue. So, thanks to my accent, you may not immediately catch the difference between these two words, so let me repeat. My first instance was preemptive war, where we try to preempt an imminent threat. Now I am talking into preventive war, something that may happen in the future, not there yet, but you speculate and you try to prevent it right now, to try to nip it in the bud so that it doesn't end up being so much bigger than it is right now. That's called preventive war. That is against international law. That is against the just war, norms of just war doctrine, the traditional just war doctrine on which many of our issues of morality of warfare are based. Now, so why I'm talking about these two types of war? The thing is that in the name of preemptive war, we are perpetually getting into preventive war. And so we're getting these two things mixed up, and that's where we are violating international law. We're also doing a lot of damage for ourselves. If we create a mess abroad and then don't take responsibility for it, and then come back home if we can. Seems like lately we can't even come back home. We're all stuck, all sorts of places. Then what happens? Then it ends up being our mess. But if we simply just clean our hands and leave, you know, and leave the mess behind, it festers, and eventually then we have to pay a lot bigger price than that. It all comes back, you know. So preemptive war and preventive war should not be confused. Now, why is it that it's happening that way? It's because of the so-called American exceptionalism, because of that idea. The idea is that anything that might be happening any place, we construe that as a threat to our national self-interest. The moment you construe it that way, you construe what could be a preventive war, meaning a long-range war, based on some long-range speculation that ends up being imminent. It's our national threat right now. And so therefore, in the name of our constitutional right, in the name of the international law on our side, like on anybody else's side, if they have to defend if they have to defend themselves, we go into it saying that, wow, if our national interest is at stake, we have to go there. So we turn what could be preventive, where there is no imminent threat right now, nor any imminent interest involved, we make it imminent by this idea of American exceptionalism. Why so? Because we are globally operative. America, let's face it, whether we admit or not, it's a global empire. American empire is a global empire. Like the Romans in the past, like the British in the past, now it's the American age, American empire. For better or worse, mostly for the better, but we have to be extremely careful. Why? With absolute power comes absolute and awesome responsibility, and we have to be extremely careful to manage it the right way, because we can do a hell of a lot of good as we have been doing. We can also do a hell of a lot of damage. Worse yet, we are doing the damage to ourselves if we do not think in a very well-planned manner. So the point is this, something in our mindset that is preventing us to see things rather clearly, and we do not have this sort of national dialogue and debate, a thriving public square in our Jeffersonian democracy that is needed to keep our democracy going. You know, most of our folks are totally ignorant of the issues and yet they do not know how much power their tax money and their citizenship carry and convey for the rest of the world. Just the other day, we saw this, you know, like some folks were asking people on the street, you know, wow, do you like between Obamacare and Affordable Care Act, which one do you like and which one you don't like? Right away, well, oh no, I don't like Obamacare at all, but yeah, Affordable Care Act, I can go for that. With that type of knowledge about our most immediate issue right here, do we expect them to have a clear understanding of the geopolitical situation in the horns of Africa, in the Middle East, in Latin America, or even our two next door neighbors, Canada and Mexico? So that's where we have to get started. And that's precisely why this meeting, this forum, and our Hinkley Institute is such an important thing, as I'm sitting here, which I have done quite often in the past. By the way, I have been teaching, you know, all over these years, maybe for about 40 years or so. When I first started teaching, most of you were perhaps in junior high school or whatever. Anyway, I do see that line. Our young, best minds must be encouraged to enter politics. My friend Robert Hinckley, that's his line. Our young, best minds must be encouraged to enter politics. That's exactly it. Without that, everything else that I mentioned, we'll be getting into this perpetual problem because of perpetual confusion. And so the answer lies with you. Thanks.
Thank you. We now have some time for some questions, so hopefully if you have them, you've written them down. And then Rachel Wooten with our Political Science Student Advisory Committee will walk around and take your questions. And you can address them to any of the panelists.
And please state your name. And stand up and state your name, and then state your question.
Hello, my name is Tad. So my question is, isn't one of the dangers of essentially the last 13 years has been kind of the military-industrial complex has gone overboard, especially with Iraq, Afghanistan, Blackwater, Halliburton, Exxon, whatnot, and that's now with the rise of the drone warfare and special forces, black ops, dirty wars, like what was it, this week in Somalia and Libya, the people just getting napped off the streets. So isn't essentially one of the major problems of U.S. policy right now is nobody wants to stop and say, let's not use brute force at the moment on either side?
I'll begin. So I completely agree with you, Tad. I think that was partly what I was trying to explain in my talk, and I think also Professor Chatterjee had emphasized as well, is that the importance of following international law, not just for all countries, but for America and the rest of the countries as well, sort of the ability to use these other options, finding diplomatic means, finding new opportunities and ways to solve international problems, not only strengthens the United States' ability to use foreign policy in the correct way, but also solidifies international law, strengthening norms and encouraging us in the future to follow similar practices, intervention not being the best of them. So I would agree with you completely, and I think that hopefully that we'll continue down this road, having seen from this experience, having gotten a better opportunity to use diplomacy and other means. I do hope that this continues on to be more of a trend in the future.
Well, I would like to just maybe add something to it. Tad, that's your name? Okay, very good question. This new trend that we find, cyber warfare and drone warfare, which is not quite cyber, but still is getting the high-tech warfare, where we call it a riskless war. Riskless for us, maybe. But where the missiles are falling, it's not riskless there. And our smart bombs are not that smart, you know. So given that, it's raising a whole lot of new set of questions. Questions when it comes to international law of warfare, when it comes to ethical questions. And we are not there yet. And so therefore, before using that as the standard norm for future warfare, We have to first get some of these other issues resolved. Otherwise, it's going to be a big, big problem, because now we think that we're technologically savvy, we have our ways, and we can do it that way. Look, technology always catches up with the rest of the world. Look at the atom bomb, you know. Until the Manhattan Project, the United States was so safe between these two friendly neighbors in the south and in the north, and by these two big ponds on two sides, okay? But the moment we opened up the door for nuclear war, when we split the atom for military purposes, thinking that, yes, now we got the power, now we're totally safe, that's when we became totally unsafe from that moment on, because now anybody can target us from any place in the world. You know, so technology has a way to catch up with us. So therefore, if we think that we are safe right now to use drones and all that, we have to be extremely careful. And worse yet, cyber warfare, you know, informational warfare, where we can paralyze the entire infrastructure of a country because of our technologically advanced means, that has consequences. You know why? Because that is extremely damaging to the other countries, even though it's not for us, and it has a clean look. Nobody is killed on the field right away. Nothing is immediate. It's nothing dirty yet, you know? But the point is that we are the most centralized nations in the whole world. If something goes wrong with any of our grids, that can really just wreak havoc to everything that we stand for, you know? And so when technology gets to be global, and eventually it will, do you know what other countries can do to us and what would happen to us then? So we have to be extremely careful before starting a new trend without thinking of the consequences, you know? So
The only thing I'd add, I concur with the panelists, but that's what actually makes the Syrian case and the U.S. non-use of force so interesting, right? I mean, after the last 13 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, as you've been teaching, you wouldn't have expected that, I think, right? Even though Obama is supposed to be Carter reincarnated and he doesn't use force ever, even though Carter used force. So that to me is why it's interesting. Where did that come from? How did that happen? How did they stumble upon it, whether they intended it or not? There are all these factors pushing that momentum and accelerating that momentum towards the use of force, because it's easy, because of domestic factors or transnational corporate factors or whatever. There are all of those incentives to use force and very few restraints. And so finding a case where you do see some restraint, even if you don't think it was intended or it was just a gaffe or whatever produced it, is interesting. And I still don't know exactly why it ended the way it did, or even though it's continuing for the Syrians. But I still think that that's something worthy of our attention, because it's so rare.
My name is Arthur. I'm an international student. I'm from Moscow, Russia. So I will come for this question from a different approach, I assume, as most of you. Thank you very much, Professor, for the speech. And it was funny to, ironic to hear about the torture laws and stuff, but we should, what's happening in Guantanamo Bay, the jail, people still getting tortures like it's the Middle Ages, so I guess it's not applied to there. And my question is, so I will go back a little bit to the war on Libya when U.S. striked. And it was supposed to be the same strike as on Syria, fast, just to maybe break up the regime and say who's the boss here maybe and stop the violence. But nobody talks about Libya now anymore. Nobody pays attention to Libya. But since U.S. strike, countries divided in three sides, there's still civil war there. There's still U.S. ambassador was killed there, and the Russian embassy got attacked there. So my question is, how is U.S. trying to put a legitimate government in Syria instead of just striking it? And it seems like U.S. government want to strike and go out, say, we did our job, now democracy should be established somehow, but it cannot be established without help from other country. And last comment, it's Everybody's saying there was a fact the chemical weapon was used by Assad regime, but we didn't actually see proof. And going back in history, I bet everybody remembers the Colin Powell proof of chemical weapons in Iraq. I hope it's not that it's not the same proof. Thank you.
So I'll just start by saying I was unaware that that the argument behind the Obama administration's reasons for attacking, and I may be incorrect on this, from what I remember of the news reports, the argument being made was that the goal was to end further gassing in the regime, and that they specifically said that they weren't intending to overthrow the regime, which is partially how they justified sort of the shock and awe attack. So I'm not sure that, you know, obviously we'll never know these things until years from now when they actually release this type of information. And so, unfortunately, it's difficult to know which is really the true purpose of what had occurred there. As far as the case of Libya and sort of trying to establish a democratic regime, I'm not sure that that was truly the case in this instance, although I know that the United States is always trying to sort of further the purpose of democracy. And then, what was the last question?
About whether it was a fact that Assad used it.
Oh, and whether it's a fact, again, that's another issue I think what it'll take. I think right now with the weapons inspectors going in right now and evaluating the situation, I think that it will be some time before we get a factual account. And thinking back to the Bush administration and Colin Powell, we know in hindsight what a poor example that was. And, you know, not the proudest moment in U.S. history, unfortunately. I hope that we won't see something similar occurring in this case. But again, I think, unfortunately, we won't know the truth for many years to come.
I can add only one quick point to that Libya question. Look, Libya is an example, one of so many examples, that's the same trend, where we somehow got involved there, then we left. What a mess it's right now. Do you know what's happening in Libya right now? We are expecting and hoping that it should be a thriving democracy or to some extent a fledgling democracy maybe will help it and all that. Look, one believe it is anything but that. It's nothing but a big chaos and problem and violence all around, all over there. That's what's happening there. Truly, truly horrible, you know. That's exactly that, in fact, confirms what I have been saying. So before we get into anything, we have to think about the consequences. In fact, a former, my current friend, former teacher of mine, Peter Singer, on the East Coast, he has this idea, a very simple formula, which is that before we decide to bomb a country, we must be able to look at that country on the map. By that test, we will fail. We don't even know where those countries are. As President George Bush, where Iraq is, you'll not be able to look at that on the map and what he has done there right now. You know? Every day, 50, 60, 70 people are dying because of blasts. And every day right now, and it has been for the last 8 years or so, you know. It's amazing. Anyway.
My name is Nick, and I've just got a question. How do you guys feel about the U.S. government trying to arm the rebels? While we didn't do imminent strikes against them, we have armed the Syrian rebels. What do you think that says about the United States and our views on foreign policy?
Brent, we have been quiet for a
I haven't sorted this out, so I'm just going to road test this here in front of 50 people. But I mean, I think that's a perfect example of having your cake and eating it too, you know. I mean, this idea that, and again, Obama, believe it or not, and I really do think he looks at Eisenhower as sort of his model of foreign policy, okay? Now, that doesn't mean that he looks at a Republican as his model of foreign policy. I don't think Eisenhower would be a Republican nowadays. But he looks at the restraint that the Eisenhower administration at least overtly expressed in a lot of its foreign policy in the 1950s. Didn't act when it could have, right? Chastised Britain and France and Israel, right, for what they did to Egypt. Imagine if an American president did that a month before an election nowadays, right? So there was some restraint overtly by by Eisenhower, but as we know, in Iran and in Guatemala in the 1950s, there wasn't a lot of restraint in terms of covert actions. And so I think that when you had all of these voices saying, do something in Syria, right, what that something would be and the and then part of and then what happens after you do something, not very, very well established. When you had these voices, the typical voices, the neoconservatives in the United States, the liberal internationalists in the media, and also some in Obama's administration saying, do something again in Syria. That was his do something. And, you know, there's a difference between motion and action. And I think sometimes the Obama administration and all U.S. administrations, and for that matter, all governments that deploy violent force, whether it's covert or overt, they forget that sometimes. But that's all I'll say.
Any other questions?
Hi, I'm Eli Lacates. I'm a poli-sci student here at the U. My question is sort of a two-part question. I was wondering, the trend is lately, you know, that U.S. hegemony is sort of declining with the economic crisis, the rise of China. As you said, technology is catching up with us in some areas. Do you feel that that will have an effect on our foreign policy in terms of restraining ourselves? And then also, my second question would be... you were talking about, like, the overt actions. Do you see that being negatively affecting as well? Because we've seen in places like Iran and Afghanistan, do you see that even having restraint? As it's seen in the past, there's been negative consequences as well as positive consequences.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Go ahead. So your first question was about the rise of China and challenging... Okay, well, yeah, that's what I was like, this is a softball, you're going to hit over the fence.
I'll start with the first question, and then I'll pass the second question on him, how's that? So, you know, I actually try and study different types of rise and decline of the United States in particular, and so I would say that I think that issue is sort of, in some circles, depending on what you're actually looking at, that might be overblown. So with the American military, there's still really no other military that can compete. When we think about international currencies, there really is no other currency except perhaps even the euro, which is a shadow to the American currency system. If we look at other different areas, there are some areas where other countries are rising. Does that suggest that other countries are able to counter the U.S. at this point in time or not counter the U.S.? Those are really debatable issues, and we've seen in the past these calls for the decline of U.S. hegemony, and they turned out not to be true. So my point is not so much that it's not happening, just that we should be cautious about claiming that those things are happening. I often write about multipolarity and moving into a new system of multipolarity because we're trying to imagine what could come in the future, what's different from what it is now. So I don't know that multipolarity, if it were to come, if it would actually restrain the U.S.'s actions, to be honest with you. I think this is a style of U.S. action. I think what might be useful in restraining the U.S. in the future is actually new norms within the United States or new leadership in the United States that would drive us along new trends, perhaps what we're seeing with Obama's administration right now. I don't believe that it's necessarily kind of the lack of hegemony that will create these changes. I think it will require something different. And so this reliance on the downfall of American power, I don't think that that's necessarily how we should look at it into the future. So I hope that answers your question.
We have more questions, so maybe we should.
Hi, I'm Dustin, and you were referencing American exceptionalism when you were also talking about norms. And I think that many people in this room would probably say that American exceptionalism is built upon the subjugation of peoples, as our nation's history has been a little poor at that. As well, that is also a norm. And for any of you who might have been familiar with Obama's response to Vladimir Putin's op-ed in the New York Times, it was riddled with American exceptionalism and exceptionalist literature. Mm-hmm. Which, how are we going to remove that norm, which is a huge hurdle? For example, the United States didn't join the International Criminal Court. That's a huge part of American exceptionalism and focusing our pragmatic, in scare quotes, agenda worldwide. So how are we going to transcend that norm of American exceptionalism? Because I'm sure that if any of us in this room ran on the political platform that America is not exceptional, we're not making it into any post whatsoever to change the world.
Well, I think you started off by answering your own question. So if you think about what you just said, so you would expect the President of the United States to use American exceptionalism. It's sort of, you know, you have to use what you got. Kind of, that's obviously the approach that he took, and it makes sense to try and, for those countries that almost fall for that still, it's useful. It gets us some kind of leverage, and it's important to use what we have. He's acting on behalf of the state, and therefore he's using what the state's powers are to achieve that, whether that's for a soft power purpose or whatever purpose that might be. So I think to answer your own question, how we would get there, I think that actually has to do with the people in the room right here. To be quite frank, I think that has to do with, you know, norms take time. They take changing of people's minds. They take educating people. The only way we're ever going to see this change of American exceptionalism or some kind of goal of Americans to be sort of on par with other nations, walk hand in hand with other nations, some kind of idea like that, would require educating and require leadership from people that are educated in this room to actually try and advance those ideas, that there is another pathway aside from using force or from using sort of a bullying tactic to achieve our means. And I think that really has to do with generations over time developing these concepts and understanding the benefit of actually using them.
You know, just to add to that, you know, the whole idea of American exceptionalism is based on this tribal mindset that I just mentioned in my talk. To get over that, we can do right here with us. As I said, you are the hope and the answer to this issue. And the question is so excellent. And in a way, you have come up with a bit hint of an answer to your own question in the very way you formulated that question. We have to see that we promote diversity more so than what we have now. We are such a diverse country in every way, a country of immigrants, and at the same time, look at our political sphere, run by two political parties, the right-wing party of the Democrats and the ultra-right-wing party of the Republicans, you know? And the difference between the two, is the difference between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. And yet we have so much gridlock. Look at Canada, look at Mexico, look at any democracies in Europe, in Japan, India, Israel. So many political parties from the extreme left to the extreme right, and yet they still get together, get going, and get their business done. And we are giving lectures about democracy all over the world, and you can't even have our own very skewed democracy in place, and we don't have any diversity. How could you have a thriving democracy without a thriving diversity? And there is no scope at this point. So it has to start not from there. It's already entrenched over there, from right over here, you know.
The only thing I'll add to that is, having you in class, I'm used to you answering your own questions. So you don't get credit for that from me. It's all myself.
We'll take two more questions.
So do you feel that by the United States not intervening in Syria, we may give rise to extremist groups in the regions and increase their influence? So for example, when the Syrian rebels seek help, and if the United States doesn't answer that call, but groups like Al-Qaeda do, do you think that gives more influence in that region? And do you think that might be reason to act in the area? Thank you.
I'll just answer really quickly and say there's no way to know.
Yeah.
I mean, we could, and you could be right, and it very well could happen. But the reverse could also be true. United States intervening in Iraq, right, if you want to call it an intervention, whatever we want to call it, that gave rise to all kinds of extremist groups as well. So if we look at the world the way I do is a completely tragic, fallen world, right? I mean, it's... You're kind of darned if you do, darned if you don't. I'm in Utah, so I have to use the G-rated version of that. But so I think that very well could happen. The question is, we always do these counterfactuals in our head, even though they're not supposed to be real social science. The question is, would it have happened anyway if the United States would have intervened? And that's a calculation that's very difficult to figure out. And the fact that the further along in the Syrian civil war we get, right? With the luster of the Arab Spring sort of in the way rearview mirror now, the more it seems like it's breeding extremism anyway. The question is, would intervention help that or would it accelerate it? I don't know, and that's why I don't want to run for office, and I want to sit here and engage at least the complexity of this without providing any kind of good answer to that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think I would agree that there's really no way for us to know either way what would have happened if we completely stayed out of it. How would that have looked to these people as well? I think there's just no way to know, unfortunately. And I do hope for the best in this case. I try and be optimistic to counteract Professor Steele. But I just don't know what to expect, to be honest.
Well, the lesson we should take from that is that you should not be getting into military operations abroad, big ones, are based on counterfactual speculations. You know, it's quite dangerous. It eventually comes back to us.
And hopefully, we only have time for one more question, but hopefully our panelists can stick around for a little bit afterwards and chat, so if you want to ask other questions.
Hey, my name's Robert Dixon. Where's the balance for enforcing international law? Does that rest with the international community, like the UN, or should America act independently? Examples like Rwanda, no one acted because the UN didn't decide to do anything. Hundreds of thousands of people have died. Whereas in Syria, we're on the verge of acting independently when the international community did make its move. Where do we balance? Where do we leave the enforcing of international laws and norms internationally or unilaterally?
I mean, personally, I think this is a personal question for people. Personally, I think, you know, as something we've all touched on a bit, this idea that enforcing international law and practicing international law over time requires us to stick to the standard of international law. Therefore, there are times and trends, you know, in Rwanda was the case where the U.S. had pulled out, was very protectionist at the time. It was a trend towards moving away from international law. We saw that under George W. Bush as well.